It was 30 years ago this month that we received the first reports of what we now know was AIDS. The disease caused a lot of confusion, as we can hear in this 1982 story from NBC's Robert Bazell.
Bobby Campbell of San Francisco and Billy Walker of New York both suffer from a mysterious, newly discovered disease, which affects mostly homosexual men, but has also been found in heterosexual men and women. The condition severely weakens the body's ability to fight disease. Researchers know of 413 people who have contracted the condition in the past year.
AIDS went on to kill more than 30 million people worldwide. It's estimated that millions more have the disease, and about a third of them don't even know it. Despite major advances in treatment, there are more than 2 million new AIDS infections every year around the world. Dr. Kenneth Mayer is professor of medicine and community health at Brown University. And Dr. Mayer, you were an infectious disease fellow at Harvard when the first signs of AIDS were reported in 1981. What was it like then?
It was a very grim time. If you can imagine, in urban epicenters around the United States, by the mid to late 80s, you had thousands of young people dying. The people who were getting sick were in their 20s, 30s, 40s, developing serious illnesses without any ability to arrest the primary cause. Unfortunately, there are many patients and friends of mine who are no longer here because of the lethal toll of the epidemic. I just think about a young woman who was brought to the hospital for her last visit in the arms of her father, who was a retired police officer in Rhode Island. And I just thought how pervasive this epidemic was, that that people can focus on risk and how did she get it, etc. But the point was that this was something that was really wreaking havoc on a very typical American family. And there were countless sad stories like that throughout the early days.
Mm-hmm. You know, you co-wrote an editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine that had some staggering statistics in it. Among them, the prevalence of HIV infection in some U.S. populations, you said, now rivals that in some sub-Saharan African countries, which was astonishing to me because I had always thought that, you know, we were treating it in this country, but in other countries where perhaps folks couldn't afford the expensive drugs, it was not being treated as well, and there wasn't as much awareness. But that's not really the case, is it?
No, there are more than 1.1 million Americans living with HIV, and more than 20% of people living with the virus are unaware of their infection, and an equally large number of people are not well engaged in care. So only about half of the people who are HIV infected are even in care in the United States at the present time. What we really have in the U.S. is a series of multiple microepidemics. In other words, there are large populations of individuals who their risk for HIV is quite low. So people who are in long-term monogamous relationships, particularly who are heterosexual, are at very low risk for HIV. But in certain urban areas, men in Washington, D.C., for example, who are Black or African-American, the HIV prevalence is more than 1 in 16 men, not with any identifier of being a man who has sex with men or an injecting drug user, but just a general population prevalence. So the epidemic is quite severe in the African-American community and quite severe among men who have sex with men in the United States.
And do you know why?
Well, people tend to have intimate contact with people within their own subgroup. So in certain urban areas, if people are not geographically mobile, once the virus gets into a community, it stays in the community. So one of the major risk factors for being HIV infected among heterosexuals is being poor, is being homeless. Those individuals are staying within a geographic area and having contact with other people within that geographic area, often from within their own race or ethnic group.
And so what can be done about those populations?
The approach to HIV has always had to be one that combines the best medical research with an understanding of the social determinants of why we have an epidemic. So developing programs that are culturally competent in encouraging people to get tested and getting people to link to care. Stable housing is an HIV prevention intervention in many settings, for example.
Are you also finding that you're battling this sort of thinking that AIDS may not be as dangerous as we thought, and if someone does get AIDS, they may be able to treat it like a chronic disease and just take medication and they'll be all right?
It's a very challenging message to get out there because there have been incredible strides that have been made over the past three decades. We can now treat serious HIV infection with as little as one pill once a day. The treatment has gotten that simple for many people. Yet at the same time, we cannot dismiss the fact that being HIV infected has chronic long-term consequences. At the present time, there's no cure, so anybody who becomes infected has to take medication for the rest of his or her life and needs to have chronic medical monitoring. So we don't want to create hysteria, and we don't want to create complacency. It's a very delicate balance. Because we are continuing to see a very high level of new infections in the United States, we have been at a plateau of between 55 and 60,000 new infections a year in the U.S. for more than a decade. So certainly for young people, getting the word out is extremely important, that there are ways that people can protect themselves against HIV/AIDS.
Now, we're talking with you as you are in Washington, D.C. at a conference about potential AIDS vaccines. How is that going? How are we doing with preventative measures?
It's been an exciting time over the past few years with regard to HIV prevention, though we still have a long way to go. We have two new prevention modalities, a gel, at least for women, a pill for men, and many ongoing studies that might define which other populations will benefit from which mode of prevention. But the challenge about these approaches, even though they're very exciting, is that these are still medications that have to be taken on a daily basis and involve clinical monitoring. We may find in the future that we can take them less often, but it's still nothing as potent as a vaccine would be. We're optimistic in the long run about vaccines, but we think it's still going to take a while. One doesn't have a crystal ball to say, is that 5 years, is that 10 years? So in the short term, there's more discussion about using antiretroviral medication for prevention, at least as a stopgap. Treatment itself can be a form of prevention. When people take antiretroviral medication who are infected, their viral load in their blood goes down, but it also goes down in their genital tract tissues, and they are less infectious to their partners. So we also think that the more people who go on treatment, we will hopefully continue to see a decrease in the epidemic that way as well.
So still an awful lot of questions and an awful lot of work to do.
Definitely. We still have a very long way to go. And the fact that we are still continuing to see more than 2.5 million new infections every year is quite daunting. So the good news is that the death rate from HIV/AIDS has decreased over the past decade or so because of the advent of therapies. So there are less than 2 million people who are dying of AIDS every year, but more than 2.5 million people who are becoming newly infected. So we still continue to have a growing epidemic, despite our best efforts.
Dr. Ken Mayer is a professor of medicine and community health at Brown University. Thanks very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.